Welcome back to F&B Soundbites, the podcast where we cover hot topics, trends and challenges for professionals in the engine room behind the food and beverage industry. I'm your host, Hamish McCook. So, Happy New Year! But is it really too late to say Happy New Year? And I suppose, actually, a lot of people listening to this will be listening to it at some other point in time other than, you know, the start of 2024. But regardless, we're glad we're back to talk on the pod about all things F&B, food and beverage. So we've got some exciting things to look forward to this year, and we cannot wait to share it with you all. So to kick off the year, I have got a question. So this will be familiar to many of you as well. You've got a brownfield site. It's not perfect. It might be causing you some real headaches, but it has got its gems, and you're weighing different options. Do you love it or do you list it? While it might be tempting to look ahead and just list it, we're here to talk about the love it option. This is, you've got a brownfield site and you're going to carry on using it. You want to make the most of it. So how to develop a master planning perspective that's critical, that can enable teams to unlock the value of your industrial facility. So today, to talk to this, we've got Michael Warne, Senior Principal Architect at Becker and Head of Becker's Design Practice Team, to share how a master planning approach can discover different angles and be the missing piece to unlock value for your brownfield F&B sites. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thanks, Hamish. Great to be here today.
Well, that's right. And it's certainly been something I've been looking forward to as well. You're a really respected member of the team, and just getting the chance to have an extended conversation with you about some of the stuff has certainly been on my hit list of things to do as well. So Michael, for the benefit of our audience and me, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Hamish. No, that's great. Yeah, look, as you already mentioned, I'm an architect. I've been at Becker for about 20 years now, but I've been in the industry for longer than that. And I guess I have learned a lot along the way, starting in a sector with residential, where you've got really client needs are front and center, and you've often working with complex and often brownfields in a residential sense as well. So that's been really interesting. Did a lot of public facility work over the years where you have lots of stakeholder groups and understanding requirements. But since I've been at Becker, the focus for me has been on the industrial and food and beverage in particular. And I guess a lot of people say, oh, that's amazing. We have architects involved in those kind of industries. And I think one of the things that we've learned in growing our team and growing with the Becker business in Australia is that the benefit that an architect can bring is a lateral thinking approach. We tend to have a broad view, and that really helps us when we're looking at master planning. So I think that's one of the things that I think comes from the career at Becker, which has been fantastic, to be honest. I guess one of the things about myself, Hamish, is while I've been fortunate in my career, and particularly at Becker, to work on design and deliver projects all around Australia and the Asian region, and as far as the UK, I've always lived in Sydney. I love Sydney. And I've always lived within 10 kilometres of where I was born. So I guess you could say, well, how come, you know? But I guess it's the vibrancy, the optimism and diversity that I really enjoy in Sydney. It's hard to feel that elsewhere, and it's a great coffee as well.
I didn't know that about you, actually. That's really interesting. Only within 10 kilometres. Wow. Yeah. You've been able to build a really interesting career just from a strong base in Sydney. That's pretty cool. It must be good for your family as well.
Yeah, it is. It's been great. And, you know, I think it's amazing. In the food and beverage sector in particular, our clients tend to be operating all around the region. And it's so fantastic to be able to help them wherever they're based. And we've had that opportunity over time. That's been fantastic.
And I just want to pick up on your point about the architects bringing a different perspective. That's exactly what I've noticed, actually, in my engagements with people in your team in these projects. No one's thinking about some of the things that the architects are thinking about, but they're important and relevant. So today, we really wanted to dig into the master planning perspective, and we wanted to understand a bit more about it in that brownfield context. But before we really dig into that, I think there might be some people who've got preconceptions about what master planning is and what it isn't. So let's talk about that. What is master planning?
It's a term that gets widely used, but people do have a different perception. So often people think of master planning as drawing some blocks on a page and pushing those blocks around and, you know, finding a nice arrangement. And I guess in a sense that is part of the activity. But really good master planning is about taking a really helicopter macro view. It's looking to the future, we want to create master plans that can last and endure. They're living documents. They're not a one-off fixed view of how things are going to be. They really need to evolve over time. And I think one of the things we find, particularly in brownfield industrial operations, is there'll be an initial stage of building work. It suits what the business wants to do day one. And over time, the business will change. It'll grow. It'll adapt. The market will change and grow. And we need to have flexibility built in so that we don't box ourselves into a corner.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. I know we've talked in the past, and some clients do have an approach where they keep that master plan alive every year, going back and just refreshing it. And that is really helpful, if only because it reminds people working in the environment that there is a master plan.
Yes.
So it's quite depressing when you're talking to a client and they won't know about something you've done 4 or 5 years ago, and you have to refer them back to this master plan document or a more strategic plan view of it. Sometimes the business forgets to maintain that longer term master plan view of a site.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, some of our clients do have the foresight, probably born out of finding that over time, Hamish, that they need to revisit these things. It's great. It's a master plan, if you think about it. It's a blueprint for the future. It's how do we see the site developing? What do we expect to happen on that site over time? And how can we make sure we're not blocking off options in things that we're doing to fill a short-term need? And then block off your options long term. And we see it all the time. You go and have a look at a site and you think this site would be so much better if that thing hadn't been put right there, because it would have opened up all the opportunities down the track. Things are changing quite dynamically all the time, particularly the food and beverage manufacturing sectors. There's many, many changes coming all the time. So we need to keep that flexibility built in.
Yeah, and I definitely know what you're talking about. Would speak to the project managers on a site have got a particular nest of projects they have to work through. And who's actually maintaining that longer term view of what the site's assets are going to be used for in the long term, assets from land or consent, whatever they might be.
Very much so. Yeah.
Maybe it'd be useful even just to talk about, so what are some of the deliverables that you'd actually expect from a master plan so that people can kind of wrap their heads around, what does the thing look like?
Yes, interesting as well, Hamish, because I guess in going back to that idea about two-dimensional blocks on a page, that's not reality either. So, you know, sites are not always flat. So it can have quite a lot going on in terms of levels and changes, some more than others. And a lot of places that we work, there's not a lot of flat land and you get a lot of complexity from that. So I guess one of the things we have always tried to do, particularly in recent times, is using 3D representation of our master plan, because the buildings themselves and the elements on sites, whether they be tanks or storage or high bay storage, they have a third dimension, and we find it helps our stakeholders to really understand what's going on when they're looking at something in three dimension. It makes it so much more real, if you like. Sometimes master plans are not all about everything being just on a flat single level. There's multiple levels in many of these facilities. And I think using the three-dimensional approach and zooming out and then seeing what that can look like. And we're able to, in three dimensions, show the staging of the work or the development over 10 years of what's planned to happen on the site. With a brownfield, we've already got elements in place. We can graphically show the ones that need to be demolished, the ones that are coming, the staging of those, how they might interact, where our flows might change and move in three dimensions. And we can even turn that into a visualization, a fly around from a helicopter view, so that we circled around the site and showed the new elements coming to the site over a 10-year period, which they then used to sell back to the broader business, thinking about your CapEx, thinking about what are the size of these things, how much are they likely to cost? You know, how much are you going to the business for your stage one work? And having those visual tools to be able to explain what's going on really can sell the ideas. And I think that's really valuable.
One of the other things that the business wants to know about when you're pitching a project is, hey, how does this fit into the longer term utilities or other sort of non-buildings assets on site? Maybe it's the consenting envelope or something like that. And changing consenting envelopes, changing technology options with respect to energy provision or other utilities. So I guess that's another aspect as well, isn't it?
The planning, consenting part of how you can develop a site over time tends to be relatively fixed. The local authority controls, they don't move fast, and they're usually fairly well known. And what we do come up against sometimes is you'll go and build your facility, push it up against the boundary, you know, want to maximize space in your first stage and all of those things. And later on, as your building footprint gets bigger, your fire authority doesn't want to see that anymore. They want to be able to drive around the site. So there's some simple things from a regulatory side that we can be thinking about early and making sure we're not creating those sort of impacts going forward. The other thing with a council is that they like to understand what's the long-term plan as well. Often you may not want to actually get consent for the full master plan, but you can. A number of our clients have shared that with the council to show them this is stage one of a future development. Often the local authority is very keen to have these facilities because they're great employers for the local community. So I think having that wider view and thinking about it early, it's hopefully stopping things coming and tripping you up down the track. Knowing where your utilities for the master plan is very beneficial. We did an example of that working with Nestle as a client when we were working in Vietnam, and they were quite a savvy client. I would say they were really thinking about the long term there, and they had big aspirations in country, and they knew they wanted to have three distinct food manufacturing operations on one site. They were building the first of them, but the utilities block, where was it going to be? How could it be expanded? How could you get to it? That was a really key driver in that first stage of how to develop that site down the track. Utilities, they're always a bit of an add-on to these type of things. You know, well, we've got to put the kit somewhere, but they're a really important part of getting something right. That's quite challenging for these brownfield facilities, as opposed to a greenfield where you've got a lovely clean sheet of paper and you can really get an optimized solution. Often brownfields mean you've already got some locked elements and you may not get the perfect solution, but it's about not cutting off options as you're going forward.
Michael, if you have got those brownfields and you don't want to block yourself and you need to work around some of those locked elements, what are some of the creative pathways that you can use to actually come up with that solution?
I've got a project in my mind that I think is so relevant here. You know, often our clients are confidential, but the approach to the site that we have here was an existing asset had been in place for, I think, about around 35 years. It already had a number of buildings on the site. And unfortunately, there were some real challenges with how things had been laid out. And I guess it's an example of maybe there wasn't the master plan at the beginning, because we had areas where we had staff and customers mixing their cars and the trucks that were moving on site. And this is a really dangerous scenario and not one that we would plan in if we started with a clean sheet. But on the site itself, a very large site logistically in a very good location in Sydney. So really it's about looking at that site and seeing where are those issues. And in this case, it was a lot about the flow. How do you unlock the flow so that we don't have duplication of truck paths? If we can get a one-way road solution happening. Fortunately for this client, they had a front entry, which they were using to bring the trucks in and out and also the cars in and out of. And often the council won't allow you to have multiple entries into one site. So that's another challenge. But what they were fortunate about was at the rear of their site, there was another way to get in or out of the site at the back, which they were using sporadically for equipment deliveries. But I guess what we were able to think about there was, what about if we unlocked that route and made a flow that could circulate more logically through the site, eliminate that risk between our cars and our trucks? And in adding the new elements, they had three key new manufacturing elements that they wanted to add to that site. And the site also was one of those that wasn't flat. So there was challenges with change of levels. There was something like a 5 or 6 meter level difference between some of those components. What does that mean? You've got to move your trucks up and down that level. That's a very, very long ramped driveway or whatever. It takes a lot of space. So I guess we were able to start to think about, okay, well, if we took a different approach, flow the trucks in a different direction, try and rationalize where we had the truck movements from the two or three components of this manufacturing facility, Can we get that to be a more optimized solution with a better flow? And then you can work out, okay, if we achieve that, then these are where the building blocks should go, rather than trying to drop the building blocks on and say, we need a new production line for our product. It's, you know, 60 meters long and 25 meters wide. We'll just drop it here. And yeah, that's where we've got space. If you can try and take a more lateral view. They did have objectives to add a number of things to the site, and we were able to consider that and get a solution in the end, which got rid of some of those really nasty complexities and give them a much better operation.
So being able to, I guess in that situation, focusing on that key constraint to unlocking the entire site, that flow of people, materials, trucks, cars, and coming up with solutions that enabled that also unlocked the entire site's ability to grow as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, practically for that client, it wasn't going to be a listed scenario. They had some really significant assets on that site that they'd invested over a long period of time. And actually, the assets were in good condition and functioning well. But when you want to add a whole new line and you want to expand, that's where you start to get these challenges. And I feel that that site did not have a master plan at the beginning because there was a diversity of the things being manufactured there. It didn't have a master plan that would create that clear way forward, but it doesn't mean everything's lost. You can recover from some of those things if you take that view out. And ultimately, that would need some things to be moved, demolished, changed. But in the scheme of things, that would also unlock the potential to be able to have a much bigger footprint for the new building if the truck movements were coordinated and integrated across the site.
Excellent. So with the master planning, so if we think about topical aspects today of decarbonisation, a higher standard for sustainability, climate change resilience, what are some of those considerations when you're thinking about developing a master plan for a brownfield site?
Sustainability, often people think about energy, but you know, there's other aspects to sustainability like reuse. So if you have a brownfield site, you've already got assets. Those assets beyond reuse, are they suitable for reuse? Are they themselves going to constrain you going forward? That's a sustainability question as much as anything else. Recently, we were looking at a project. It's quite a developed site. It's been there for some 20-odd years operating. It's really getting tired and constrained. And you look at the asset, and you really have to do that at determination early. You might need to do some condition auditing as well to determine, well, if we did reuse that building and changed its operation from food preparation to wash up or some other component, what would have to happen? And in the project that I'm thinking of, that was clearly not going to be a good expenditure of money. There was really not enough life left in that asset to then go and spend more money on the asset. And it was going to be a compromised arrangement because of the floor levels and ceiling heights and other components. So yeah, I think sustainability, and you can call it adaptive reuse of buildings, sometimes it's perfect. Sometimes you'll have a lovely warehouse that's on site and you can readily fit that out for your project, and that's a really big win. But I guess there might be times when you have to really take a hard look at your assets that are on the brownfield and decide, you know what, that asset's really in the wrong place. It's beyond end of life, time to move on. Sites are typically built over time. You'll probably have a range of building types. You really need to be thinking about the resilience piece in sustainability. You know, with the climate change, we've got lots of adaptions about things like, where's the flood level going to be? Is the floor level in the existing facility actually long-term going to be sustainable? Sometimes industrial facilities have been built next to rivers, and historically they're in those kind of locations. And they probably are going to be the ones that are most impacted by that climate change if we get sea level rise. So you really need to be thinking ahead. You don't want to go and spend a whole lot of money upgrading the fit out of a building and then only to find that down the track it's not going to be functional from a flooding perspective. The other part of sustainability, I guess, Hamish, is the solar piece. And we see a lot of that now. Often you can't retrofit solar onto some of these older brownfields buildings. They were never designed to have that load applied to their roof. So you need to do some analysis. You can't just assume those things. So we certainly had examples where the client has been very keen to do that kind of upgrade to their site as part of master planning, but it will mean actually strengthening the roof of the buildings to be able to put the solar up there. Fortunately, as we go forward, things like the building codes are getting much more in tune with this type of thing. And in Australia, it's mandated that your roof has to be designed to cope with a solar panel load, whether you're putting it on or not now. So we're finding the newer buildings are already going to be accepting of a solar panel load. Those are some of the challenges with sustainability.
Solar panels would make so much sense when you've got a nice, big, lovely roof span, wouldn't they? Yeah. So that's interesting because we started talking about love it or list it. And I guess the proposition was, well, you can love it and there's a brownfield master planning approach, but you just pointed out some of the key considerations that might actually mean it could be an opportunity to list it. And especially if it is prime real estate, there are others that might really want to use that space for something else.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Hamish. And just touching on while you're mentioning that, I guess the other thing about existing brownfield sites, certainly in and around the major cities, they tend to be in pretty good logistic locations. They've been in an industrial area, they're well serviced by roads. That tends to be in place for a lot of those sites. And the idea of love it or list it gets a little tricky when you look at that, because even though you may have not an optimized layout, you may well be in a location that you won't be able to achieve if you were to list it and move on. So that's another complexity of the master planning, is actually thinking about, is the site itself well located? Is it well served for services, roads, access? Is it close to rail? Easy access to the airport. The clients are often loath to move because they're in logistically in a good position.
Yeah, well, one thing I'm taking from this conversation is there is a lot to consider when it comes to long-term master planning for an industrial site, brownfield, and of course, if you're setting up a greenfield site as well. So as we draw ourselves to a close, and the aroma of coffee from your local Sydney roastery is probably permeating through. Michael, are there any key takeaways you'd like to leave our listeners contemplating?
I think the key takeaway from me is think about a master plan from that helicopter view. Try and move away from the immediate and the pressing and move out to a wider view. It's very helpful with master planning to take that perspective. Draw in your plans for the future. What's the expectations for the business? How do you see things growing? What are likely to be the changes that are coming for the business? And some of them are easier to predict than others for sure, but I think it's very important. And I think you really need to look at your existing brownfield asset and decide, what are those key things that are there that are of value, of benefit? You know, is it going to be a sustainable solution for the business going forward? We're seeing the electrification of the whole logistics supply chain coming soon. Most sites are not ready for that to happen with charging of trucks and vehicles. And there's a lot of things that you need to think about. But I think take a step back would be my key call out for master planning. Try and look wide. Don't get bogged into the detail, because the details often can be resolved in a number of different ways. But if we don't get the fundamentals right, we can well trip ourselves up going forward.
Yeah, well, that's been a fantastic little masterclass for me, actually. Thank you, Michael. And there's a lot to absorb there. And I guess reflecting on the fact that you've been doing this for a long time and we've been doing this well, and I guess the acid test has been that we've been able to refine our approach and our experience over time as well with the same clients again and again. So we must be doing something right in this space. So if any of our clients are out there wondering how they approach this, I'm sure you'd be happy to field a phone call or an email and just actually carry on this conversation with anyone out there that's interested.
Oh, absolutely. That's, you know, something I'm personally very passionate about, and I think Becca is really well placed to do. I think just thinking back to what we talked about, Hamish, one of the other things to think about is we do have in Becca a really broad team of people with some really creative ideas. I'm talking from an architect perspective, but I work in a multidisciplinary organization. And that's one of the joys that I find, is that we can bring those skills together. And that's really the great part when we're collaborating with a client. bringing the best of our teams to combine with their teams. And you get those creative thoughts bubbling up, and master planning can be done in a very collaborative way. A workshop is a fantastic way to do it. So we'd be more than happy to set up those discussions with any client to have a high-level master planning workshop is often a really great place to start.
Brilliant. Good call. Well, thanks very much, Michael, for sharing some of your insights with me and our audience this morning. It's been fantastic.
Thanks for having me along, Hamish. It's always fun to hear the soundbites and the thoughts of our people and how they can help with the work that we do to make every day better.
Good on you. Absolutely. And thanks to our audience as well for listening in. As usual, if you want to learn more about this, in particular, if you want to learn more about master planning and the work we do with clients, feel free to connect with me or Michael Warne on LinkedIn or at Becker. Be sure to check out our other episodes of F&B Soundbites on Becker.com as well, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So yeah, thanks very much to you all for the first episode of 2024. Many more to come, lots of interesting stuff. So cheers, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Cheers, Hamish. Thank you.